Good morning. It's Friday. Welcome to the roundtable for this 27th of October. Very nice to have you with us, and we are grateful you decided to spend a few moments with us, and maybe even longer. That is our job, to make sure that it's maybe the whole, you know, the whole time together. That would be lovely. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It is the 27th of October. Let me introduce our panel to you. A reminder that you can be included in our conversation by simply writing us a letter. We for the most part, like your letters. Roundtable, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. P-A-N-E-L, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll be getting to some of those in just a few minutes. Let me introduce our group to you this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
How do you do?
Thank you. Former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck is in the building, and we couldn't be more delighted. Thank you very much
for being here.
Good
morning. Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pasitti is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. And our good friend, an amazing author, an amazing storyteller, Joe Bruchak joins us again.
Happy
good
to be
morning.
Back again.
It's wonderful to have you here.
And he brought his flute. Maybe we can convince him to play a tune.
I think he can play us in and out of the breaks like
absolutely.
You did last time.
Awesome.
Yeah, you did. Be great.
Cool.
We love when you're all here, so thank you very much for being here. Anybody have anything before we start on the topics? Anybody have anything? Oh, hey, what have you got coming up tomorrow?
We have our annual Scary Story Night at our Outdoor Education Center up in Greenfield Center.
Mm-hmm. And the name of the center is?
The Andakina Center means our land in the Abenaki language, a word almost no one can produce properly out of their mouth, but Andakina, and it's on Middle
That's
Grove
why
Road
I asked
Greenfield
you,
Center.
Because I was thanks. And what goes on at the Scary Story Night?
Well, myself and my two sons, Jim and Jesse, who are also professional storytellers and outdoor educators, we do traditional Native American stories, and the first part of the show is scary stuff, and the second part is truly terrifying, so we ask people to leave with their small children unless they want to.
Wow, you're
going
to cover the Trump administration?
Yeah, I was going to say, is the truly terrifying stuff like the truth?
It's not that scary, interestingly enough.
Well,
You've got a point there, Joe.
Okay, so it's even scarier than that.
Oh. Or they could take them to see the scariest film I've ever seen in my life, which I have never forgotten, Bambi. Bambi was a scary story.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Anything where your mother gets killed by hunters.
You bet.
that's a nice way to look at it. Tomorrow all day, there's an interesting renewable energy and sustainable living fair put on by a bunch of environmental leaders in Rensselaer County. It's at the Doan Stewart School in Rensselaer, I think from 10 a.m. till 3, and I'll be speaking at noon on climate change. But I think the real draw is you can go around and talk to solar energy companies, geothermal companies, electric cars, look at the green roof at the school.
That's great.
Free and open to the public tomorrow.
Doan Stewart School tomorrow.
Yep.
Aaron, you doing anything fun?
I'm going to see the Glens Falls Symphony next weekend.
Oh, that's lovely.
My wife plays the violin, and they are
nice.
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, right. Oh, they are great.
Really? Sibelius's second symphony and a Mozart piano concerto.
I knew she was a talented writer and grandsman, but I didn't know that she was a violinist.
And a Class 5 whitewater kayaker.
Wow, you learn something every day.
I just want to say I love Glens Falls.
Isn't it a great
city? I didn't really appreciate how wonderful it was until...
Hometown USA.
Yeah, a few months ago there was a climate change rally, including a march for about a mile. And so you really got to see the community. And it's such the foothills of the Adirondacks, but such a great city.
It was also the home of my favorite art museum. An art museum which is not selling its art, but that's another topic.
Nicely
for later
done,
today.
Joe.
The Hyde, right?
The Hyde collection.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous.
A collection is a place where things are brought and remain.
Yes, they even add to it,
and they don't.
And I think on Saturday there is a big protest march at the Berkshire Museum to protest the sale of this art. It's a horrible situation. It really is.
I want to do a quick. Did you have anything else going on tomorrow?
Yeah, we're going to go to the movies tomorrow night.
Oh, good. What are you going to go see, Bambi?
I think we're going to see the one about Queen Victoria.
And Victoria with Judi Dench. Yeah. That looks great.
She's always good.
I think we're
going
to go see that.
You're not going to go see It for the fourth time?
I have to say I love that movie. Quick shout out to a friend of ours, Dr. Philip Glotzbach, who's the president of Skidmore College, last night was on stage at the Zankel Music Center interviewing Paul Simon.
Wow.
And it was an amazing evening. He did a terrific job, and Paul Simon was great, Dr. Glotzbach was great, and it was, 580, 600 kids that were in the place, and it was just a beautiful, special evening. So hats off to them. It was very, very special.
I would just like to add that if we have two finer citizens than Phil and Marie Glotzbach, I don't know who they are. They're just wonderful, lovely people.
And he was so thoughtful. And you get this idea. This struck me as I was watching. Of course, Paul Simon's lyrics are to me second to none. I just think they're perfect and beautiful. And but Philip is a philosopher. So you have a philosopher interviewing just this lyricist and the songwriter, and it was magical.
At a
it was
terrific really, college. So
yes,
I'm
it was.
Glad
it was
the students
really,
got that exposure.
Really fun. So
I know anyway. I married one of them.
Married an alum.
Yeah, the fact that Simon did so much to bring world music to the national stage.
That's right.
Is another part of his
and he
brilliance.
Talked about that.
But
he
not
did.
Without criticism. He was called out for that
in the 80s.
In the Graceland years.
For
South Africa.
They're co-opting as opposed to cooperating.
That's right. That's right.
And then there was the whole Garfunkel thing.
He would not talk about that last night either. A student asked him about it. And he said, no, I'm not going to talk about that. So that's fine. All right. Let's get on to business here. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. And we have a lot of stories to discuss. So let us go. Let us begin with the House approving a budget blueprint clearing the path for tax overhaul. The Republican race to overhaul the tax code broke into a sprint on Thursday, with House members narrowly clearing a budget blueprint that would allow a tax bill to pass Congress without any Democratic votes, and Senate leaders signaling that the bill could be introduced, debated, and approved in both chambers by the end of November.
We don't even know what's in that bill yet.
No, that's right. There's two ways to look at this. You can look at the economics of the tax cuts, or you can look at the legislative process that's being used to ram them through. So I think the legislative process is extremely deceptive in that you have the House voting on, a $4 trillion budget. $1.5 trillion of that is a placeholder for the tax cuts that literally have no details now aside from raising the standard deduction. There's no specification. There's no specification about income limits, what the top rate's going to be, how multinational corporations are going to be taxed on foreign earnings, and this is going to be bad.
And I think it's really interesting that it only passed the House by a vote of 216 to 212. Mm-hmm. Most New York Republican House members voted no, with the exception of Collins and one other I can't remember. So this kind of reminds me of the House attempt to repeal health care. That was tight, and we know how that ended. And so Paul Ryan, the Speaker, was in the media yesterday, kind of half jokingly saying he's happy that President Trump is going to be on international travel while this debate unfolds, so that one tweet can't derail their negotiations. But I think they're very far from reaching agreement.
Does he know that he can tweet from Asia?
I want to say something about this, putting on my legislative process political hat, and that is that when they come up four votes on top, it's a bunch of nonsense, because what happens is the leadership has to decide who they're going to, quote, let off the hook and say, okay. So they make sure that they have the votes, and then they come out four short. Right? I mean, I think that's the way we used to say, you're either in the tank somebody comes up, you say, "Hey, I've got my people are killing me." You say, the boss says, no, you're in the tank.
I always loved it on that point, Alan, when in the New York State Legislature, when there are hard votes, yeah, and they would say, "We're letting legislators vote their conscience." And I'm like, shouldn't that be every vote? They only get to do that occasionally. Right. Yeah. I mean, they're so far in, yeah, they don't realize how kooky it sounds.
just care about this one.
And right, then they get all reelected. That's the terrible thing.
Yeah.
But, well, they count the votes, but what votes really count? When it comes to the vote that counts, where will they vote? And often you'll find suddenly 4, 6, 8, 10 of those votes are negative rather than positive.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Here's the problem. If you get the blue states, all of which, for example, are going to get killed. I hope everybody out there is listening, either in Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York. If you're not allowed to deduct your state and local taxes,
your mortgage, for that matter. Yeah,
the mortgage, I think they're going to keep. Maybe. But then you're in real trouble. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a tax increase. So if you're, Aaron, I'm fascinated by you, the economist, because, you know, there are these other states. Why would a congressman from another state not vote to enrich his people at the expense of New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and California?
Well, they're blue states. You know, the fact that it only passed by 4 votes is pretty remarkable, because I think once the details of the plan come out and where they're going to find this offsetting revenue, whether it's the state and getting rid of the state and local tax deduction or what's equally as egregious and going to hurt more people is the lowering the amount of tax-free or pre-tax 401k contributions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's going to affect a lot of people. Yeah. So I think if that becomes part of the revenue-generating part of the plan, I think a lot of Republicans are going to be very upset that they ended up voting for this budget.
But you know what I'm thinking, and that is, if you read The Art of the Deal by, you know, Trump or by somebody who calls himself Donald Trump,
Tony Schwartz.
Yeah, you will see that the idea is to put stuff on the table that you can then take off later. Mm-hmm. There are already Republicans in the House who are saying, you know, that stuff isn't going to go. So we'll see. Of course, it could. And I could be wrong about this, but then I think that's stuff that they put in there to trade with.
Sure.
Right, but we also are seeing the immediate death of fiscal conservatives in the House. This vote yesterday increases the federal deficit by $1.5 trillion over 10 years.
Chump change.
Yeah, where
I mean, that's almost 10% of the national debt.
Yeah.
By the way,
where's the Freedom Caucus? Where's Mark Meadows? Mm-hmm. He's signed off on this, and so I actually have a soft spot for fiscal conservatives. I think there is some waste that can be dealt with, particularly in the military budget, which is half of the federal budget. But this is just building the deficit more and more, you know, contrary to everything they say is their fundamental bedrock principle.
Right. And in a time when you have rising entitlement obligations with an aging population, with Social Security and Medicare.
And maybe no more 401k contributions at an adequate level. Yeah.
This whole process reminds me of the Arrested Development episode where Job takes over the Bluth Company and tries to build a house in two weeks.
Yes.
Michael's like, well, we can't do it in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks! And they're trying to get this through the House and the Senate by Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took Reagan a year plus to do it. It took George W. Bush a year plus to do it. Tax reform is not simple. And if it gets through in that time, it's going to be very ugly.
And we don't even know what's in the bill yet.
Well, I asked this question yesterday to our panel, but I'll ask it to this panel, which is this strategy has not worked for them in Alaska. I don't know why you do it again.
I think I have an answer to that.
All right.
Get inside their minds. It's tough. Whoa. You may remember when Gary Trudeau had a thing where he would siphon into Reagan's ear to get into what
that is a truly terrifying tale for you.
I was going to say, Brushak, yes. Halloween indeed.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that they know that people are just going to react and salute when it comes to tax cuts.
Right.
Not in a way that they would when you're trying to take their health care away from them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, so the top 1%, more or less millionaires and above, are going to see about a 25% increase in their after-tax income.
Hey, they need that.
They do, obviously. And then the bottom 80% of the population is going to see about a 1% increase in their after-tax income. And again, since the details aren't finalized, these are estimates by the Tax Policy Center based on the very flimsy information that has been floated by the Trump administration. So it's pretty clear that this is not a middle-class tax cut. It's a giant handout to millionaires and billionaires. And that's not surprising given who's in Trump's cabinet. You have Steve Mnuchin, Gary Cohn.
It's all true. But the problem is if people don't know it, it doesn't matter that we have a brilliant economist on our group here who is telling the truth. It only matters that people say, I want tax cut. It's that simple.
Yeah, I think you're right in that people just want to hear that they're getting a tax cut, and your very compelling numbers of average, middle-class Americans are getting a 1% bump up and corporations are getting 25%. I'm afraid a lot of them are going to say, well, as long as I'm getting something. But it's interesting that every Democrat voted against this, and they will have a good megaphone in the next few weeks or days to try to educate the public.
I think it's that metaphor of the house building one is one we need to look back at, because almost everything the Trump administration is proposing talks about the upper stories, but there's no foundation. And if there's no foundation, it can't hold.
Excellent.
I mean, the other thing, building off of Judith's point, is that, yes, everybody does get something. Right. Even the bottom 10% are going to see another 1% increase in their income. The issue is that $1.5 trillion could be spent on a lot of other programs that would benefit a lot more people in a lot more equitable ways. And I'm surprised that, $1.5 trillion could fund 75% of our infrastructure needs over the next decade. That would put people to work. That would boost middle-class incomes.
It's all true. But that's why 85% of the Republicans are sticking with Trump. 85%?
It's amazing.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have much more to discuss, and we will do that right after this short break. Was that The Who? Very nice. Okay. From now on, though, from the rest of the breaks, we're going to let Mr. Brushak play the flute. Okay? And I forgot to tell you that. I'm talking to Liz, our engineer. So, of course,
much more than let. We are going to appreciate us doing that.
Yes. So we'll get to that in just a moment. Hey, welcome back to the program. It's very nice to have you with us this morning. Let me let you know who else is here. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Henk, Aaron Pasitti, Joe Brushak. We have quite the panel, and we're very excited. We also have a bunch of letters. Let's get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics.
All right, Joe. Thank you for that. Daisy knows exactly how to get my attention. She writes, Alan is right. People just hear tax cuts. They're selling it as a corporate tax cut that will mean higher salaries for ordinary workers, not 5 explanation points, and that's from our friend Daisy, who's always on target. Jim from Poughkeepsie says, people who can afford it the least are still behind the Trump Republican agenda. Exactly. The panel talks about this often. We see it here in the tax plan, where people who need tax breaks the most are some of the Trump Republican base and can't possibly understand or follow how these moves to transfer wealth are threatening their livelihood along with the rest of ours. Once done, it will take generations to untangle.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Just feel you can always say anything, group. Ryan's optimism. I think Paul Ryan vastly underestimates the reach and power of President Trump's petulant incompetence. Thanks. Chris from Albany.
We're counting on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bambi. Is it Bambi? Okay. Good morning, panel. Pinocchio was much scarier than Bambi. Remember the island of lost boys where disobedient boys
that was scary.
Were turned into donkeys and then whipped? Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pinocchio was the first movie I ever saw. I remember being frightened by that.
Disney is actually scary stuff.
It is frightening.
Yeah.
But then when Wizard, and some people probably, Wizard of Oz with those flying monkeys? Good Lord.
I love those monkeys. Yeah.
Well, now you do.
But as a child, they're frightening.
Right.
And Gary says, isn't yesterday's vote just a sham framework? where only purpose is to set up the reconciliation rules for tax reform and Obamacare repeal so they can pass it with only 50 votes in the Senate. Gary from Oneonta.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of that. This is not how tax cuts have normally been designed in the past.
It's not how the legislative process works. And when John McCain often uses this phrase, we need to return to regular order, what that means is you get to see the bill, you have hearings, you hear from all sides, and then you're free to make a bad decision or a good decision. Yeah. But this notion that you essentially look at, you know, talking points, and then the legislation comes later. I mean, I think it's highly unusual.
Yeah, it's the road to totalitarianism. Yeah. It is, because, you know, the one thing we have is, you know, this tripartite, you know, government where people look at each other. And when you have people like Nunez, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, playing ball with Trump the way that he has and the way we've gotten him, it's just astounding. Okay, good morning, panel. Russ says, the question facing the Republican Congress has been, who is liable for the growing deficit? They want to be sure that the debt is owed to the greatest extent possible by those needing the government services purchased. This is the old Reagan ploy. Russ from Menands, what do you think, Aaron?
The biggest cause of the deficit is not entitlements. It's not tax revenue. It's a combination of that. It's really the number of workers who have jobs. So when unemployment's low, tax revenue's high because you have more people working. And when unemployment is low, you have less people relying on income support programs. So the reason Clinton ran a surplus in the late 90s was because the unemployment rate dipped down under 4%. So, you know, it's smoke and mirrors to talk about, you know, tax cuts and government spending. It's really about the state of the economy. The state of the unemployment rate tracks the budget deficit almost perfectly. So if Republicans are serious about or fiscal conservatives are serious about reducing the deficit and the debt, they should be creating programs that put people to work, whether it's the New Deal or a giant infrastructure package. Mm-hmm. But, you know, guaranteed employment and public employment would literally get rid of the deficit.
Well, better employment, too, not people being paid something at basic minimum wage, which itself is much too low.
Yeah,
and having to pay two jobs. When it's interesting when the administration points to the lower unemployment rate, they don't make the distinction that for a lot of people, they're working in low wage jobs, multiple jobs. You know, two, three jobs.
And often under a limit so that you can get benefits.
Right.
Now, I'm going to say the obvious, but as I walked down the street in Great Barrington, I don't think there is a store without a employees wanted sign on there. And yes, I think, Judith, your point is extremely well taken. You know that these are jobs that are not great paying jobs, but they can't find enough people. And at the same time, the ICE people are coming around and scaring the hell out of others who would take those jobs.
Oh, yes. I know several businesses in Saratoga Springs that lost almost all of their restaurant workers with an ICE raid.
Mm-hmm. Right? Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. They swept in and took 20 people from one particular business I'm not going to mention.
Saratoga and the Mid-Hudson Valley took a real hit on those ICE raids.
My colleague, Aaron Dom Mendel at Siena College, and I did a study with the Siena Research Institute where we created a survey and asked New Yorkers about like 20 different aspects of their job to determine whether those were quality jobs. So from pay to, you know, stressful positions to getting time off, about a quarter of the jobs in New York State are bad jobs in that they don't pay enough, they don't offer benefits, they don't offer, you know, a flexible schedule that works to the employee's advantage. So, you know, of the 8 million jobs the economy has added nationwide since the recession ended, almost all of them have been bad jobs. It's called the Uberization of the workforce.
Mm-hmm. I don't get that. Why is it the Uberization?
Very insecure employment, relatively low pay.
The gig economy.
Yeah, the gig economy employees are shouldering all of the risk associated with their financial stability.
Well, that's true, but let me compare Uber with taxi drivers. So what is it that makes the taxi cab drivers better because they have to have, you know, they have to have certain kinds of
their shifts, and there are and they are employed. It's not something that they are going to get the licensing and to become a driver.
You know, Joe, I've been talking to a lot of Uber drivers. When we take an Uber, mm-hmm. and many of them used to drive cabs, So this is a choice that many many of them have made.
But when you talk to them, a lot of them will say, but the nice thing about it is I can go up and say I'm dropping my son off at school for band practice, and I have 3 hours.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Well,
so
exactly.
I can drive a car for 3 hours, right. And then I can come back.
Sure.
But it's the opposite if you work in retail. What I find amazing is you don't have the same schedule every week, mm-hmm. So you right. can't easily arrange childcare. You know, the bus system may not work, you know, late at night. I think Starbucks addressed this. I'm not promoting Starbucks in any way, but they saw that their workers were really struggling with, you know, one day you start at 8, the next day you start at 11. And so they created a computer system that had some predictability in scheduling. Why can't every store do that?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
Because it costs money and lowers their profits.
said the economist. Yes.
Robert writes, state and local taxes. If state and local taxes lose their deductibility, couldn't the most harmed states change their taxation model to, say, an enhanced sales or value-added tax like those states now use? That would really screw up the Republican game plan. And that's from Denise, actually. Not Robert, but Denise.
Yeah, that would be complicated. It would be done on a state-by-state basis. But, yeah, that would... One possible solution.
But it doesn't. Does it answer the progressive question, the progressive taxation question?
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
So there you are. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Tom. Yeah, good morning. $1.75 trillion would go a long way to building the way that Mexico's the way it says here, but it's the wall.
Yeah.
It changed the wall to way that Mexico's going to pay for, and that's from Tom, who I know is going to look at this stuff before.
And no, Mexico's not going to pay for it, but that's another story.
Well, of course. Good morning. I think he's a freak. Okay, so now, good morning. Since the public has not seen President Trump's tax forms, I feel there should not be changes to the budget or tax code. There may be changes that benefit him personally. Thanks for the opportunity to comment. And that's from Ted. Good point.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get on to move on to some other topics. I assume we want to talk about whitefish.
Absolutely.
Find out what's going on there. A fascinating story. And we'll have Joe Bruschak bring us into our break. Joe Bruschak playing us in and out. Tell us about the flute. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, that's a Native American flute made of red cedar, a basic pentatonic minor scale. And the flute, we say, mimics a human voice. You can sing whatever you can play on the flute. And the idea that we share that music and that breath of life is where the flute is built, connecting us together as human beings.
Beautiful. Well, thank you very much. We'll be hearing more from that. Let's move on to another story and talk about a very interesting story that escalated yesterday. Bipartisan concern in Congress went on for a second day Thursday over the slow pace of power restoration in Puerto Rico and a $300 million contract given to a small Montana energy firm to help repair the island's electrical grid. What do we know about that firm? Well, Representative Bob Bishop of Utah, chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources, and Representative Bruce Westerman of Arkansas, chair of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, wrote a letter directing the head of Puerto Rico's public utility system to retain all records surrounding the hiring of Whitefish Energy and to turn documents over to Congress. Meanwhile, 35 Senate Democrats signed a letter to the heads of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, better known as FEMA, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, calling on the Trump administration to establish a clear chain of command for who is responsible for coordinating work to restore power to the island. Judith, think what happened.
Well, today as we speak, 74% of people in Puerto Rico still don't have electricity. Many still don't have access to clean drinking water. And I don't think they're going to get electricity back until sometime next year. The Whitefish contract is interesting. It was signed by an entity called PREPA. It's essentially a public power authority. It's a monopoly in Puerto Rico, and it has been very poorly run for decades.
I'm sorry. So is it a agency?
Yeah, it's
Or is it a privately owned?
No, it's publicly owned.
Publicly owned.
And
okay.
The only place you can get electricity from in Puerto Rico is from this publicly owned public power agency. And they have a long history of inefficiency and corruption.
And aging infrastructure.
Aging infrastructure. Most of the electricity comes from 60-year-old oil-fired plants that should have been retired long ago. So I'll get to Whitefish in a moment, but I want to point out a really important thing, which is right now FEMA is funding putting the old electricity grid back up, not renewable energy,
as it was.
They have a policy. They rebuild what was damaged during the storm as it was. And so Whitefish is out putting up electrical lines and bringing this polluting, unreliable grid up over some period of time. There is an effort in Congress led by Senator Schumer to allow FEMA to fund renewable, resilient electricity in Puerto Rico, because my fear is if they don't do that, the next hurricane will be right back where we are now.
Right.
So the Whitefish issue is important in that Whitefish is a two-person company out of a small, small town in Montana that's only been around for 2 years. I think it's safe to say they don't have the experience and the resources to do this job. I think what has Congress interested is they are based in a very small town in Montana where Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is from. And I would not hold the...
Say that again.
Okay, so Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary, is
that's
from...
That's a coincidence, right?
That's what he says. Zinke says he had nothing to do with this. It's a coincidence. And I think Zinke is distinguishing himself as perhaps one of the more ethically challenged cabinet members in the Trump administration.
That's very diplomatic.
He does the private flights a lot. He's been, it's been pointed out that he does partisan fundraising while he's doing public duty work. He was only, I think, a one-term Congress member, and he got the Interior appointment because he's a hunting buddy of Donald Trump Jr. And he's the guy who's in charge of all of our public lands. So Congress is investigating, is this really a coincidence that this underfunded brand new company got this multi-million dollar contract, and FEMA is saying that they have very serious concerns as well.
And there was no formal bidding process for the awarding the contract.
Yeah, and I heard this, I read this kind of crazy story, how PREPA selected Whitefish was there was a previous bidding process that only two companies bid on. They were one of them, and one of the senior PREPA people happened to have the phone number of Whitefish on him during the hurricane, and so he called. Yeah, I guess we just all fell off the turnip truck. This really sad, sad thing is this is not serving the people of Puerto Rico. Yesterday it was 89 degrees and humid, no electricity in 74% of the homes. And while Whitefish really needs to be investigated, we can't take our eye off the urgent humanitarian need to get the power back on and then to rebuild the grid based on renewable energy such as solar microgrids and not old oil plants.
Well, in many ways, we're treating Puerto Rico the way Haiti was treated. All that money went in supposedly to help Haiti, and it all went into the pockets of contractors and big business.
I think that's a valid point. I hope Whitefish is isolated, and I hope Congress doesn't get so focused on Whitefish that they don't focus on the bigger urgency in
Having been to Puerto Rico, an island that I truly love, it has incredible potential for renewable energy.
Yes.
It has everything you can imagine: tidal energy, wind energy, yeah, solar energy.
Year round.
And none of it is being optimized as it could be.
There's only 2% renewables in Puerto Rico. Mm. And I dealt with PREPA a lot when I was at EPA because they consistently violated the Clean Air Act. We were always bringing enforcement actions against them. And I would say, look, let's retire some of these dinosaur oil plants and you've got abundant sunshine, as you say. But they're just one of the most incompetent public agencies you can imagine. And really, my fear is everyone will throw up their hands and say, look, you know, the Puerto Rico government is dysfunctional. They can't get anything right. That is true some of the time. This governor is new. He just took office in January. But if we kind of dismiss this, the people who really suffer are the families of Puerto Rico who still don't have electricity.
Could you put into just some context for me as to the cost of $300 million? I mean, is that a lot?
Yes.
Because it didn't strike me as...
Yes.
I mean, to do the job that is needed.
They're going to need a whole lot more than $300 million.
Right.
But $300 million to a two-person company that's only been around for 2 years.
Oh, for them, right.
Yeah,
yes.
But my educated guess on what it takes to bring electricity back in Puerto Rico is if you do the rickety old fossil fuel grid, probably $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to really make improvements and do solar microgrids and battery storage and tidal and wind, probably a little bit more than that. What's mm-hmm. interesting is the price of solar is coming way down. Solar is cheaper than fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So, you know, $300 million is maybe a quarter or a third of what's needed.
Okay, so let's talk about the EPA for a moment. You have an op-ed piece in The Hill today in regards to hurricanes, and this comes as the fifth anniversary of Sandy as a bonus. So your point in the piece being?
The point is that EPA plays a vitally important role after hurricanes, you know, getting drinking water to people, making sure sewage treatment plants are functioning, mm-hmm. Some responsibility on electricity and debris management. So we know that there will be more fiercer storms due to climate change. I mean, we're living that now with Harvey, Irma, and Maria. And yet, the Trump administration wants to cut the EPA budget by 31%, mm-hmm. more than any other federal agency. Mm-hmm. So I argue in a very well-written piece in The Hill this morning.
I would agree.
That this is no time to be cutting the Correct. EPA budget. In fact, I think we should be enhancing it. EPA has hundreds of people on the ground in both the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico doing basic things, trying to get people drinking water. And the timing of these budget cuts could not be worse. So Congress will do the final budget in December, and they've already expressed some interest in not going mm-hmm. that deep. But they mm-hmm. are looking at cutting the EPA staff by many thousands, even out of Congress.
Well, in many ways, EPA is more important than FEMA, because FEMA is immediate but limited. EPA is long-term.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Were you surprised by Monday's action of not letting climate change scientists
estuary meeting in Rhode Island? I was not that surprised, but I tweeted that I think the EPA scientists should show up and speak anyway and see what happens because. They have a really important voice. That wasn't me.
It was my fault. I turned the thing on.
Right under the bus. I think the EPA scientists have...
I thought the Bob Newhart show was starting.
And while we're at it, I just want to say how I resent the appropriation, as a Jewish boy from the Upper West Side, of the word whitefish, which is one of the more delicious
yes.
things.
That did strike me as yeah. well. We used to think of whitefish as a really positive yeah. thing, but
why
now
does it make
it's...
me think of blackwater?
Yeah.
Or whitewater,
yeah,
for that
yeah,
matter.
Yeah. It's a combination. But, Joe, I think it's terrible that EPA scientists were on the schedule to speak at an estuary conference in Rhode Island, and they were said, you can go, but you can't speak. Come on. So I can tell you, as a former federal regulator, it's virtually impossible to fire anyone in the federal government, even when there is cause. So I think these EPA scientists should show up and speak and just let's see what happens.
Go out in the lobby. Break off into a smaller group. Hey, come with us. All right, let's take a break. We'll have Joe Bruschak play us into our next break. We'll hear news from Ray Graff. When we come back, we will tackle some letters. We will get to other issues as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Joe Bruschak with us this morning and playing beautiful music. By the way, just a reminder that you can, I assume we can hear you play on if we go to the event.
Yes, scary flute music.
Scary Story Night is taking place at the annual Pumpkin Contest. This is in Greenfield Center, New York, and it takes place tomorrow, October 28th. And fun starts at 6:30 with a pre-carved pumpkin contest, and then 7 o'clock, there'll be stories, scary stories for younger kids, and then 8 o'clock, the really scary stuff.
You are on Doc, you know, Education Center, N-D-A-K-I-N-N-A, center.org. You can find it on the web, and we welcome people to be indoors and outdoors if the weather is well doing scary stories.
Excellent. Joe, thank you very much. Aaron Pasitti is also here, an economist and a professor in the, well, you're an economics professor at Siena College, and he is with us this morning. Judith Eng, former EPA regional administrator, is here, and Dr. Alan Chartok, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some of those letters, and then we'll move on to other topics at hand.
At one point, let me just characterize a lot of letters. There are a couple of things that are going on. Number one, we're getting a lot of letters about Joe Bruschak and the flute playing.
Yay.
And we thank you for doing that. And a lot of people,
my
of
pleasure.
Course, in love with Judith Eng and for all of her service and are saying that one way or the other. That's not to deprecate anybody else in the room, Aaron or Alan or anybody else, but they really have been effusive in praise for both of you, and I thank you for doing this.
Maybe next week you and I could bring our banjos.
Yeah, well, you and I play banjo together. Okay, here we go.
I love that idea.
So yeah. Patrick says, at one point, Judith said that Elon Musk was going to help in the restoration of the electricity system in Puerto Rico. Is there any follow-up on this offer?
Yes. Thankfully, Elon Musk has offered all sorts of solar battery support, but we're running into this problem of FEMA will only fund what was existing prior to the storm. So he's not going to get federal funding for this. And then there's going to be engineering dilemmas when you have him trying to do solar microgrids and the federal government funding oil. So it's not going as well as hoped.
Okay, and then we're greetings to Joe Bruschak. 20-year belated thanks to Joe for allowing our writing group, Writer's Block, to picnic in his backyard when we visited his literature center. Wonderful panel. Keep up the great work, all of you. Stay vocal. And that's from Richard.
That's very late for a thank you note.
Better late
Emily,
than never.
That's true. Emily Post would not approve. 20 years later.
What was postage then?
Yes, that's
but
true.
But I was on his mind all that time.
That's a good point, really.
You sound like an economist.
Michael says, the flute player has such a beautiful and calming voice. He should be in radio. His flute playing takes me somewhere else, and that's from Michael. All right. And
I wonder where they went.
And then Connie says, yes, there are a lot of part-time, low-level jobs now available. This sounds good, but most people I know with these jobs cannot even take a second job because their schedule keeps changing. It's impossible to put two part-time jobs together. Who can survive on 10 hours a week on minimum wage? P.S., thanks for the beautiful flute playing. So there you go. And Mike says, the other thing about Uber and Lyft drivers is that they are independent contractors. If their car needs maintenance, the drivers are financially responsible. This cuts into the Uber driver's income. If a taxi driver's car needs maintenance, the taxi company is responsible. Besides, calling Uber and Lyft ride-sharing companies is a misnomer. You ride, you pay. Sounds like a taxi service to me, and that's Mike from Glens Falls. Let me just, and we had one letter from somebody who worked at Starbucks who said, you still got a defined schedule. It hasn't changed. Remember we talked about, you know, the fact that
your schedule may vary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your schedule may vary.
You know, talking about scary stories, when we tell scary stories traditionally among Native people, there's always a moral to it.
Yeah.
The scary stories we're hearing now are immoral.
Oh.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, let me argue with you about that for a minute, Joe. That's interesting that you say that, because one wonders whether there isn't a moral to the story we're going through right now. And it's a scary story, right? It's a very scary story.
Yeah, but it still could be immoral, right?
Well, there can be immoral to it, but when you have immoral people behind it.
Yeah, somebody pointed out in a letter, you take Grimm fairy tales, you take Disney, you take these others. These are pretty scary stories, right? I know that we sit there with our little three-year-old grandchild who likes to watch television, and we... we're very concerned about the messages, even on the good shows, you know, the good kid shows, which come across and are, you know, and they, you know, the hyenas, right? And then the hyenas in one of those shows, and the hyenas are bad, you know.
And that would be the Lion King, right?
And he says, I'm scared. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm scared. Mm. That's scary. So it's out there.
Well, that's the message of literature. Literature has, just like tragedy, you can watch a tragedy and then it's over and you can feel uplifted by having experienced it. We're in the midst of tragedies that are ongoing, like Puerto Rico, or like what's happening with the weather of the entire planet. We have to find ways to make meaningful decisions and create solutions, not increase the problems.
Right, and not tune out, because the problems seem so overwhelming. I love
change the channel.
Joe, I love the guest you had yesterday. Remind me of the poet's name.
Luis Alberto Urrea.
Right.
He was great.
He was fabulous.
I
caught one thing he said about why young people are feeling hopelessness and turning to drugs and how young people don't have hope for the future. And he kind of slipped in. I don't think it was an intended dig, but he said, you know, when you've got Bill McKibben running around talking about climate change and it's all kind of hopeless. And I thought that was a very odd take on things, because, climate change is very discouraging, the more science you know.
Yeah.
But you can't tune out and put your head in the sand.
No, you have to be careful not to scare the life out of a coming generation.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the economy and economists are doing a good job of engineering that.
Yeah. Oh, I think, you know, Bill's last book, Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, basically said that, you know, that we've been saying, you know, when it's too late. And basically Bill was saying for certain parts of this, it's too late.
Yes.
And
he's right.
And he's right. And so I think that's what it was in reference to. But it is all scary stuff.
Can I go
but
back
I admire
to
and love Bill McKibben, I
absolutely.
Say.
No, yeah. I mean, he's one of our...
He's a hero.
Yes. We are all parts of the...
and indebted to him.
Yes. We're all a part of the Bill McKibben fan club.
Yeah. Let me go back to the, if I may, to the letter writer who wrote about, you know, the Uber compared to the good people in the taxi companies. Well, let me tell you, the good people in the taxi companies, a few people owned a lot of those of those medallions, and they made a lot of money off of other people's labor. So I think some people are having a sense of schadenfreude here, because the value of those medallions, which people invested in and got mortgages on and stuff, have gone down. And there's a move in New York City, for example, to compensate them for the value of those medallions going down.
Well, the other downside of Uber is mass transit ridership is down in New York City.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, I've taken Uber. I admit it if it's late at night or it's raining hard or the subway doesn't go where I need to go. But
or if it's going, if the subway's going.
Yeah, a growing problem in the city. But mass transit is our best. I mean, it's so convenient, and it's our best tool to combat climate change.
Correct. Well, go to Western Europe. Go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can go to France and be on a train that's going 200 miles an hour and be somewhere in almost no time at all. That would take me half a day in the United States.
Shame on us.
You know, a lot of economists look at the rise of Uber and Lyft as like, oh, this is competition. This is what it's supposed to do. This is, you know, providing an alternative to traditional taxi rides. But like Judith said, all that does is, you know, suck resources and demand out of funding for a very efficient mass transit, whether it's high-speed rail or more bus routes or local
in New York City. I mean, the ridership is down, and some of that has been documented.
Because there's
of
a good
Uber
reason a lot of it is down,
and it's unreliable. I mean, I note I was in New York City for the past 7 years, and I noticed a real change from when we first moved there to when we were leaving. More delay. People are late for work, and it's because the state of New York and the city of New York have not invested in maintenance of the subway system.
Well, how about when subway tunnels get flooded by a major hurricane?
Sure.
Now you got Airbnb, of course, and you've got you know, these are, as has been pointed out here, these are competitive things that just arise because there's a need in some people's minds for them. And then there are always the lobbyists, for example, who go to the government and say, you got to prohibit our Airbnb. Now, I have to say, my wife, Roselle, has a little cabin, and she uses it for Airbnb. I have to, you know, I mean, I shouldn't really do that because there's a potential conflict here. But I have to say, she was standing on the corner the other day in New York City, and there was a lady standing next to her, and she said, are you waiting for an Uber? And she said, no, I'm waiting for, I don't know what the term was, where you can go anywhere in New York City for $5, as long as, that's right, for $5, as long as you're willing to go with somebody else. In other words, they'll pick you up and they'll...
Uber allows for carpooling.
Yes, Uber pool.
I always do the pool option.
I love it.
But this is different.
This is only $5 to get where you need to go.
Now, I don't know if that includes Brooklyn or not. It's hard to believe.
Probably just Manhattan.
It does include the luggage rack.
It's hard.
Joe would know.
Just get on the back of the cab, go down.
Luann from
your skateboard.
Luann from Northampton, which is a terrific place, says, as a co-owners of a small retail business, we do offer a set work schedule, and the owners average a pay rate less than our employees, not raking in big bucks. Shop small and local to create positive change. I agree with that. I always try to buy local. Always.
Yeah. We want to go to her store, Luann.
Okay, go to Northampton. It's a terrific town. It's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
So JC says, hi, panel. I haven't heard a comment on the little girl being held because she's illegal in our country. You all read about that.
For surgery, right?
That's right. When President Trump announced all illegals who were criminals would go back to their country, he never mentioned children, especially children who have a disability. This is beyond cruel. Mm-hmm. Is there nothing we can do to help this child and others we have not heard about, JC?
Give me your poor, your huddled masses, and I'll push them into the ocean.
All right.
Did Stephen Miller say that?
Let's talk about Mark Halperin for a moment, top political journalist facing multiple claims of harassment. And here's a guy who was, I think, known as one of the big political
leader.
Insiders. Yeah. He was the guy, worked for ABC as well as MSNBC, and had several books to his credit, including Game Change, which was about the 2008 election with John McCain and Sarah Palin, and that was a TV movie on HBO, and the new book was just coming out on the 2016 campaign. He already had that underway with HBO to do a film of that. They canceled the film early yesterday, and then later in the day, the publisher said they weren't even going to publish the book now. As a result, he is on leave in MSNBC and has long since left. ABC, obviously. So, it is yet another story. And what we're hearing in this particular case is a lot of people with a very similar story coming out in large quantities.
It is so disturbing, and it is so widespread in so many different industries. I mean, I liked his book. I would have watched his HBO series, but it is now canceled. You know, a case could be made, innocent until proven guilty, but he seems to be...
owning up.
Saying that this, in fact...
I acted inappropriately.
This was, I just love when these guys come out with the statements, you know, and if this offended anyone in the past, I apologize. Are they idiots? I mean, you know, some of this behavior you should know out of the gate is a problem, creates a hostile work environment. Some of this is cases of sexual assault, and it really gets me thinking about Anita Hill and Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. That was supposed to start the conversation on sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace. And it sure seems to me we have not come very far as a nation on this. And I think the high profile cases are interesting. You know the actresses who are saying Harvey Weinstein offended or attacked them. But I think the deeper conversation we have to have is the pervasive problem of sexual harassment and what it means for women who don't have economic clout. What does it mean for the waitress? What does it mean for the farm worker? What does it mean for women who can't, you know, walk off jobs or say no to scripts? This is just scratching the surface here, and it needs so much more attention.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm interested in your take on the George W. H.W. Bush story.
Yeah, so disappointing. I mean, so if you're not familiar with the story, an actress came forward.
Heather Wind.
And she said that the former president touched her inappropriately, told her a dirty joke. The defense from his spokespeople were that, well, his hands kind of wander, and secondly, he tells that joke to everyone. So he tells a dirty joke to everyone to get them to feel relaxed around him?
And part of the defense, too, was, well, we told you not to stand next to him.
Yeah, please.
the thing is, he did fess up, right? I mean, he didn't...
His staff fessed up, yes. Yeah. And his staff need to make sure he's not in those situations where women, I guess, are standing within 5 feet of him.
Well, because he was in his wheelchair, and apparently he has the women come over to, when they're in pictures, to block the wheelchair. And then he touches them and then tells them a dirty joke. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
I'm very passionate about this. I think we have to realize that men have to realize women are their sisters, their mothers, their wives, their friends, their equals, their co-workers, and they are never just symbols or objects. And we have a long way to go as a nation and as a people to recognize this within traditional Native American cultures where they have all these stereotypes of women. It's the other way around. Mm-hmm. Women empower men rather than the other way around.
Okay. I agree with you entirely, but yet we see this parade of people coming out and saying this person, this person, this person, this person, this person, and it is all horrible and tragic and deeply troubling. And then you think about where we were a year ago with our president of the United States and what he said and then we elected him. So I mean, what does that say? I mean, if that doesn't send a mixed signal, what does?
So my question to Judith then is, what, adding on to that, is what about the women? Now, we know that the EPA went down in this country largely because of white women. A lot of people voted against it.
ERA.
What'd you say? The ERA. What did I say? EPA.
You said equal rights. That's all right.
Sorry about that.
Got it.
Yeah. And we have seen large numbers of white women, I think a majority, voting for the president after they came out with this horrible thing about grabbing genitals. Mm-hmm. So you're right, Joe. I mean, it's very disappointing, and we have a long way to go.
Well, I can't speak for all women, but it is certainly disappointing that large numbers of women voted for President Trump after what Steve Bannon calls Billy Bush weekend, which, you know, is really quite offensive in and of itself. But, you know, I think what we can do is work in our own communities, in our own workplaces, at our own schools. I was surprised to read this morning that in Congress, they don't even do sexual harassment training for congressional staffers or members of Congress. And if you are coming forward with a sexual harassment complaint, you can't file it for 3 months. You have to have a three-month, quote, cooling off period. So this is a problem in government, in the private sector, and there needs to be anti-harassment training. There needs to be a strong EEOC. And it also needs to be addressed by men, not just women. This whole notion that women kind of whisper to each other, avoid being in a room with this guy, skip a job with that guy. I mean, we all have a responsibility. And women are talking to each other more and more, but these are painful conversations.
It is. And also there's that pattern of the abuser being defended by the abused. When you're an abused person, often you're in that kind of twisted but strong relationship where you will deny to law enforcement or to people in authority that you have been badly treated in any fashion, including sexual abuse.
Especially if you may lose your job or you may lose a chance at a promotion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm kind of impatient with the perspective of at least we're having a national conversation about this.
No.
We're way past the need for a national conversation. And if I was a CEO of a company, and when I was a regional administrator at EPA, I had to push hard to get, I was surprised. We didn't have mandatory anti-harassment training. And we busted our training budget to do that. You know, training is not the only thing, but it gets people thinking. And, you know, one thing about some of these high-profile people losing their jobs or contracts is it may make people think twice before they continue this behavior.
Applause.
We are out of time, and my thanks to
I need another hour on this show.
I know. You can certainly... You'll be back. Don't worry. Banjos next week.
Yeah.
Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pacitti. We are going to close with Joe Bruschak and just quickly reminding you about Scary Story Night taking place tomorrow night in Greenfield Center beginning at 6:30. We'll let Joe play us out.